Committee will now come to order. The time is 1:05 p.m. on Thursday, January 29th. Members present are present. Did that twice in a row. Representative Kopp, Representative Costello, Co-Chair Holland, and myself, Co-Chair Mears. We have a quorum to conduct business, so we're just going to go ahead. I'd like to remind members to please silence your cell phones. A reminder for staff and members of the audience may not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to community members, please get the attention of Co-Chair Holland's committee aide, Tim Truer, and he'll take care of it. Importantly, I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole, the House Energy Committee Secretary, and Doug Bridges from the Juno LIO for tech and teleconferencing support. I wanted to provide a short update on our last meeting where we heard presentations from the RCA, Harvest Midstream, and NSTAR Natural Gas Company. A representative from the RCA followed up with our committee aides with a message stating that they had acted upon Co-Chair Holland's suggestion that the RCA could perhaps bring all the players into a room to facilitate some direct confidential communication to work on some of the issues surrounding the dueling proposals for natural gas import facilities. Responding to the suggestion during our last meeting, RCA Chair Espindola stated he would bring the topic up for discussion with the commissioners at a public RCA meeting scheduled for yesterday. The topic was indeed brought up yesterday, and the commission unanimously voted to open an informational docket in which the commission will convene a public and confidential setting for Chugach Electric Association and NSTAR Natural Gas Company to discuss the issue of LNG import facilities. And with that announcement, the first item of business before the committee is an introduction of House Bill 252, Electric Utility Fire Prevention Plan by Representative Kai Holland. Please approach the bench, introduce yourselves for the record, and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Mears. Thank you for the introduction, and to the rest of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 252. I'm Kai Holland, House District 9 representative, forgetting to introduce myself, and staff Aiden Nickel will be assisting me with the presentation today. I do want to take a second, though, and just kind of frame what we're doing here with a little bit of background. Some of you will recall that in the last session we had House Joint Resolution 15 that was a resolution addressing the critical and urgent concerns about the wildfire danger we were anticipating in the spring of 2025 due to low snow levels. And that resolution that we developed through the course of the session was eventually passed and transmitted on by the governor, addressed a broad set of issues around what we could do to reduce the wildfire risk to our communities. And I'm pleased that, you know, in the process of developing that work from Division of Forestry, from the Anchorage Fire Department, and many other jurisdictions came together to, I think, last spring, do more sooner to be prepared for the wildfire season than I've seen in a number of years. And I appreciate all the work and all the projects that happened during the summer. A lot of the work that I've done in this area actually, though, goes back to 2018. And just briefly, if you recall, in the summer of 2018, we had the Paradise Campfire in California with a tremendous loss of life and building structures in California that really brought to bear in the consciousness of many communities around the country this growing issue of large-scale fires destroying significant portions of our communities. And in the course of that, then later in the year, we had the earthquake in November in Anchorage, where we then saw the impact of a large disaster and the difficulty that we all had in kind of finding current information and realizing we weren't that well organized and prepared for being able to respond to a major incident. And it began work that I did first off in my local community council, and then interest in the work we were doing in resilience expanded out to other hillside community councils and eventually has included community councils from the Eagle River Chugach area all around to Turnagain Arm and out to Girdwood that all realized we needed to do more to be prepared to understand what we could do to reduce the exposure to wildfires. And in that work, we also learned from our wildfire science professionals that the view was that a large catastrophic fire on the hillside was not a question of if it could happen. It was only a question of when will it happen. And I didn't want to accept that as the answer, that we were just going to have to wait to figure out when will we be a Palisades, when will we be a Lahaina, when will we be, you know, any number of other communities that have had to suffer a major catastrophic wildfire. So I've begun over, you know, at that time working through the community, working with other professionals and organizations to explore different ways we can understand and reduce the chances of a catastrophic wildfire. And it's my hope that we can change where we're headed with large urban perimeter wildfires. If we go back 100 plus years ago, we used to accept that we had large urban core fires. We can think of Chicago, London, Seattle, Fairbanks, Seward, places where there was a major catastrophic fire within the core of the city that burned down a bunch of it. And that was because of building construction, density, lack of apparatus and water systems. And remarkably, over decades, we essentially solved and eliminated the urban core massive wildfire risk. We still burn buildings downtown, but we don't ever think these days about losing an entire downtown urban area and all of the, you know, downtown neighborhoods. We've put together sprinkler systems, fire hydrants, we have fire departments, we have building codes, we have fire alarms, we have secondary exit. We've done a bunch of changes to the way we construct, manage, and create the response apparatus so that we don't have to worry about burning down all of the urban core. But today we're confronted with a new risk that has surprised us, especially when we saw Lahaina burn and realized that even a place as beautiful and we think as special and tropical can still suffer major fire. So where I'm headed with this bill and other work I'm doing, and what I want to encourage people as we explore this legislation, is to see this as a part of a broader framework, exploring the questions and the steps we can take next that would allow us to work towards a day when massive urban perimeter fires are no longer something we tell residents that is not a question of if we'll have it, it's just when. We will always have forest fires, and to some degree we need forest fires. That's a healthy, natural thing. But I believe we can get to a point where we could have urban perimeter fires, and we may scorch a lot of paint. We may have to have people, you know, evacuating to get out of the way of it. And perhaps we may still lose a house once in a while, but we don't have to sit and worry about will we be the next Fort McMurray, the next Palisades, where we lose a substantial portion. So this bill is one piece of a lot of interesting work going on that builds upon what is already happening. Utilities are working very hard to understand their role in managing their utility assets and the right-of-ways that they manage, which are really critical portions of, in the case of our hillside, the infrastructure there that's creating the power we need, but also those rights-of-way are really critical for access in there. And they've been working diligently on improving how they manage their right-of-ways. And across the western U.S., we've seen this type of legislation now becoming an essential component of helping utilities have the framework under which they can create their plans, engage with other partners that are doing community wildfire protection plans or managing forestry and response, to let the utilities and their management of the right-of-ways be one of the tools that is helping us overall reduce the risk of wildfires in our communities. And so I'm appreciative of letting me have a moment to kind of tee up where we're going with this. What I'd like to do now is turn it over to Aidan Nichols' staff, who can start walking us through some of the details of this bill. And I look forward to the questions and discussion later and future opportunities to develop this. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Holland. Thank you, Chair Mears. For the record, I'm Aidan Nichols, staff to Representative Holland. And I want to start here by presenting a scenario. So we have a power line in a narrow right-of-way The utility company can only clear vegetation in this narrow right-of-way, but it's surrounded by trees taller than this narrow strip is wide. The adjacent property owner may not know that the trees on their property pose a risk to power lines. So what happens when a warm, dry wind comes along and blows the tree into the power line, causing a shower of sparks? Not only do we have a severe wildfire risk, we also have a public utility being sued for damages from this wildfire, and there's a high likelihood that ratepayers are going to feel that cost. This isn't a hypothetical. It's a scenario like this that produced the McKinley Fire that burned 3,200 acres and 52 residences in Willow in 2019. And to make matters worse, in the lower 48, some utilities are so worried about being bankrupted for wildfire liability that they are shutting down entire portions of their grid when wildfire risk is high. So Representative Holland's proposed statute builds on a solution that's been adopted in Montana, Utah, Idaho, and other western states. The bill would require utilities to adopt wildfire mitigation plans. If they have these plans approved by DNR's Division of Forestry and they follow their plans, they receive limited liability protection for damages from wildfires. The plans require utilities to assess wildfire risk and notify neighboring property owners if there's a situation where a tree on their property is threatening power lines. And so the intended result is we have a lower risk of wildfires, we keep utility rates from rising due to lawsuits, we reduce the risk of indiscriminate shutoffs, and property owners are notified about risks on their land. The key part of Section 1 creates a presumption that a utility is not liable for causing or failing to prevent a wildfire, so long as it has followed a wildfire mitigation plan. But importantly, this is not an absolute protection, and the other provisions in this section outline the areas where it doesn't apply. The utility is not protected if it acts with gross negligence. It's not protected if vegetation in its right-of-way causes the fire. It's not protected when it's working outside of its property or right-of-way when it's not authorized to do so. And it's not protected when it causes vegetation to make contact with a power line. Additionally, this section allows a neighboring property owner to enter an agreement with the utility for the utility to manage vegetation on that neighboring property. And it clarifies that a neighboring property owner is not liable for any damages caused by the utility doing work on their property. Section 2 describes what must be in a wildfire mitigation plan. The plan must be in writing. It must be approved by the Department of Natural Resources. It has to assess the likelihood both of a fire starting in the utility's property or right-of-way and of a fire starting in neighboring property and spreading into that utility's area. The plan has to contain procedures for maintaining and upgrading electrical infrastructure, for shutting down power lines when wildfire risk is extremely high, procedures for vegetation management, fire detection, and the notification of emergency response agencies, and procedures for maintaining access routes to high-risk areas. The plan must contain a process for balancing the impacts to consumers of a shutoff against the risk of a fire. And finally, the plan requires a utility to notify owners and occupants of an adjacent property if its assessment shows a high wildfire risk. Section 3 simply applies the Act to lawsuits occurring after the effective date. I'd like to add here that we have received two fiscal notes, a zero note from DCCED and a fiscal note of $674,000 from the Department of Natural Resources for staff and travel. Thank you for the time, Chair Mears. I'm going to turn things back over to Representative Holland for some further comments before questions.
For the record, to note that Representative Edgman joined us at quarter after. And we also have on the line for questions, Norm McDonald from DNR.
Great. Thanks. Again, Kai Holland, House District 9. Just to wrap up on this, I appreciate the opportunity to develop this. You know, the fiscal notes that we've got, you know, represent a intent that we would engage the Department or Division of Forestry in being able to review these plans and to ensure that there's coordination with these plans with the community wildfire protection plans and the rest of their planning area. There's some more work, I think, to be done to assess the scope. I think right now, the way the bill is drafted, it is fairly broad in terms of the number of utilities that might be involved. So there's also some options of being able to potentially look at the fiscal note in terms of changing or limiting the scope of involvement. But for the moment, we introduced this with a fairly broad desire to provide the Division of Forestry a lot of latitude in considering how they would be involved, and we appreciate the response they've given us in assessing this plan.
Thank you very much. Representative Costello.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I was curious, what is the process right now? And I imagine we're going to have the utilities weigh in on this, but what is the process right now that the utilities use for their fire mitigation? I imagine that there are plans in place. What authority does the department have, or does this bill contemplate if a mitigation plan is not approved and there needs to be changes? I mean, would the department be directing the utility then to make changes? And you know, what does the bill say about that? And then my third question is, are you aware of any opposition to this bill? And if so, could you talk about what that is?
Sure. Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Costello. In terms of the current approach to mitigation efforts along right-of-way, what I've learned from discussions with the five primary utilities in a rail belt is that each of the utilities do have their own plans, and they are all very actively working on this. So this is not something new for them to do. But to that degree, what I've learned is that each utility right now has their own approach to different levels of technology that they're using to do their assessments, and they're coming up with schedules on when they do their work. I think it has allowed the utilities to develop plans that they felt were prudent for their lines and the vegetation and the exposure that they have. So I don't expect that, and it's certainly not the intent of this legislation to fundamentally change the ability of the utilities to have a lot of autonomy to develop their own methods of being able to address the mitigation efforts that are there. In terms of the role of a Division of Forestry review of the plans, we have not been prescriptive at this point. The original outline of this legislation from other states simply asked utilities to create a wildfire, or in some cases a wildland mitigation plan, and to simply file those plans with their regulatory agency, PUC, or in our case, an RCA. And we wanted to, in the case of Alaska, recognizing the work being done by the division to help catalog and be engaged with the community wildfire protection plans, we wanted to have more of the subject matter expertise that the division brings to be the subject matter expert to review those plans, rather than asking the RCA to have to become a subject matter expert on looking at these plans, or just simply having a rubber stamp file it and nobody ever even looks at it at all. So that's a long-winded way of saying we haven't outlined what the administrative process would be for the division to actually review the plan and their criteria to assess whether or not they're accepting it or pushing back and maybe suggesting some changes. I'm hoping that that dialogue, perhaps on the more of the regulatory administrative side, might develop versus needing to have that level of prescription in there. And I'm sorry, I think I lost track of the third piece of your question.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. Is there any opposition to the bill that you're aware?
Thank you. Didn't mean to lose track of that one. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Costello, there's two areas of concern that have been raised so far. One has been the concern about the fiscal note, and I take it as a friendly concern in the sense that I think the utility that raised this concern genuinely would like to see this legislation move ahead, and they're sensitive to the fact that if there's a fiscal note on it, it might jeopardize being able to move this ahead. And their effort is more to help ensure that we can move this ahead. So their suggestion has been to try and dial down the scope or level of involvement of Division of Forestry as a way to reduce the fiscal note. That being said, you know, we'll be looking at a supplemental appropriation. We'll be looking at our regular appropriations. We're spending, you know, $50+ million or more on wildfire work. So starting off, if there is a fiscal note with this, if this is a way for us to reduce some of the wildfire exposure and to save millions of dollars on maybe catching a fire sooner or reducing it, I think it's worth having a discussion about, is this the kind of fiscal note we should keep? So at any rate, there is a concern about trying to get rid of the fiscal note in order to reduce the chance of this bill getting stuck. The other concern, of course, and predictably, is coming from the insurance industry. And we have met with them in an initial meeting yesterday. I will offer that this bill comes out of the work in Montana in terms of finding a way to create some flexibility in the liability shield that the utilities get. This type of bill has been through the legislature or reviewed a couple times in past years, and the old version of this bill that created a significant amount of industry or insurance industry pushback generally was the type of bill that basically said utilities can't be sued, and the insurance industry said that level of shield was too much. So as staff Aiden Nichols went through, this one offers a balance, we think, of still providing not complete immunity and not complete shield as responsibility. But to your point, the insurance industry will be and has expressed concerns about this bill in terms of any time there's some protections against who's going to pay for the cost. They would like to limit the protections that this might provide the utilities.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Holland, your staff for bringing forward this bill. It's covering a lot of important topics. I want to kind of narrow in on one issue that it seems this bill does a pretty good job talking about the property, the easements, the rights of way that the utilities own and that they control. But it seems less clear to me that when the risk is coming from outside of the right of way, that we're doing anything here to provide utilities a vehicle for giving notice to an owner, your tree is leaning towards the power line. You know, we haven't walked over on your property, but just walking our own easement, that tree looks really questionable. And giving them notice, and then they're not doing anything about it. And then ultimately it becomes a crisis for the utility, as your able staff say, when the wind blows and, and things. So how are we addressing those situations where you have an adjacent property owner who's been given notice that their vegetation is creating a real problem in the utility's right of way? How do we balance that? And
thank you for the question. Through the co-chair Mears to Representative Cobb, that is fundamentally what I hope this bill is really advancing, because in the legislation and other states that we've looked at, that issue is not addressed at all. The existing legislation in other states, and we've worked through CSG West that's working with other states, they've primarily, you know, looked at this legislation in terms of what's in the right of way and providing some negotiated levels of responsibility for that, and that's where it stops. This legislation is going, to your point, to a new place, which is informed by two things. One is we now know that the utilities are doing some pretty sophisticated scanning of their utility lines. That includes not only what's right in the canyon of their line, but they know exactly what is beside the lines. They're using LIDAR techniques. They're using satellite techniques. So that data is really amazing. And so this bill is requiring that they provide that information and that notice to those adjacent property owners when they find that there is vegetation that would be a hazard to the line, and to ensure that there's some mechanism for them to be aware of it. And where this idea originally actually came from was we've been approached earlier on about how could we create a structure that would allow a municipality or the state to enter into an agreement with a utility to let the utility, while they're already out with crews and doing all the work, let them be able to take care of some stuff that they find outside the right-of-way that might be on public land. And so this was really an outgrowth of trying to create that ability to work together. So the specific point that you're getting to, though, which is really the hard place, which is, you know, where's the balance in this? This bill is not prescriptively placing a requirement on the owner to do anything. The owner can voluntarily participate in a vegetation management plan with the utility. That is, they can enter into an agreement that says if there's something on the adjacent property, they could enter into an agreement that would allow the utility to just take care of it. And I could anticipate that'll happen in the case, again, of state property, municipal property. That'd make a lot of sense. All the equipment's there. If this is a private property owner, they're going to get information saying you've got some hazardous vegetation. We've not said in this anything about any requirement on what they must do. Mm-hmm. This is a problem, and I think it's a challenge for us because, in essence, we are letting the property owners know what they are essentially responsible for anyway. But we will have provided a pathway for them to be noticed about it, and they're going to have to consider their decision of whether or not they take down that tree, if it's a tree, or leave it there because they like the tree. And, you know, on the hillside in the area where I'm at, people love their trees, and they have been very frustrated with the utilities even taking down the trees within their right-of-way, much less going a little further out. So there's a gray area here. We've not been prescriptive about it, but we're trying to make sure that those adjacent property owners are going to learn about the vegetation. The final point I'll make briefly is we do already have a strong program through the utilities on how they handle dangerous or hazard trees. So if the utility finds out that there is a hazard tree, a danger tree in some cases they call it, that is a tree that is dead, like a dead spruce tree or a tree that's damaged, there is already a very explicit pathway for that utility to go to the private property owner and say, you have a dangerous tree right on line, we need to take care of it. Mm-hmm. This legislation and this notice to adjacent property owners is dealing more with where you may have healthy live trees beside the line, but they could still, in a high wind situation like the McKinley fire, create a danger. So I'm not giving you a very clear answer, but this is not a very clear situation, but we're trying to bring more information into the assessment, the data that we have, to understand where these risks are and then how we might help property owners.
Yeah, property owners and rights of way and easements is a favorite subject of mine.
Exactly.
Some people will tell you about. I'm recognizing there is a shared duty, a shared responsibility when you live next to a power line that you don't contribute to a public disaster. And so your property interest has to be balanced by if you are given notice that you have a high liability tree. And you do nothing about it. Maybe this is a Department of Law question, but it'd be nice to know that, because I think from the utility's perspective, they certainly want the liability protection, but being protected from liability still doesn't save them from that tree falling into the line, and they're not liable for the forest fire, but there's still a massive job ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like there needs to be a vehicle to be able to do a preemptive strike on that if they really see a high risk tree, because some property owners simply don't want you on their land no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that can be considered the Alaskan way sometimes and so on. But that there is a duty to keep your neighbor safe. And And, you know, we recognize that in the more urban environments, but in the more rural environments, and sometimes that duty you have to other people isn't quite as clear. So I appreciate you're trying to thread the needle on this, but...
A follow-up?
Yeah.
Thank you, to Chair Mears. Just two quick comments, because you're raising a really valuable point, and thank you for bringing it up. And perhaps we ought to bring in Department of Law just to kind of make sure we're clear on the liabilities being created here. But two things that I would note that we've tried to be attentive to here, too, because the utilities, and when we were working on this with them, also expressed the concern that if we create this structure of doing the assessment of the right-of-ways, and we now make this a statutory thing that we have to do this assessment, share the data, well, what happens to us as a utility if, when we do a scan, we happen to miss a piece of vegetation that's not in our right-of-way, but maybe our technology that we use just didn't catch that particular tree, or maybe it changes. Maybe they scan the line in August, and in September we have a big windstorm, and now the property owner doesn't know that that windstorm damaged the tree. Their scan was done before that. So the utility is saying, you know, don't make us now responsible for a level of vegetation scanning and assessment that creates a liability for us. So there's also that side we're trying to thread here. And so we've got some language in there that is trying to make it clear that we're not asking utilities to do some sort of exceptional level of scanning and, you know, fidelity of data that is unusual here, that we're asking them to do what they feel is prudent, document it, do it. But if there's some vegetation that is missed or changes, we don't want them to be liable for that. On the flip side, there's also language in here in terms of the wildland mitigation or mitigation plan that is really looking beyond all of this, because to the degree that utilities can come up with, and they are in many cases using new technology that can do fault detection, so that if the lines start touching a piece of vegetation, they're more sensitive, they can just shut off right away, not stay on until they cook something and turn it into a fire, that if there is a high wildfire danger situation, they can turn off their automatic reset system, because right now most of the lines are set up, so if there's a fault, it will try and automatically reconnect, and it may try two or three times before it finally says something's wrong. Well, they now have new technology that can essentially, in a red flag type of day, say, if you detect any fault, we're going to shut that line down. We're going to go look at it first. So we're trying to move also beyond just the vegetation contact. There's other pieces of this plan.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. I'll interject for the record. Representative Johnson joined us at half past and has a question.
Well, I would just say that if ours shut off every time something, a branch touches a line, we would never have power. Well, I'm just saying, in the valley, there's so many trees and so much. But what I'm wondering, and I apologize for not being here for the detailed explanation, but, I did have a very special, large, expensive tree that I didn't think they needed to. I don't know why they were cutting it down, but it was there, and it was in the city. And, you know, eventually, with a little bit of complaining from me and a little bit of, you know, starting this way and that way, eventually we got to where they at least didn't cut the whole thing down. But it seems to me like if we get too prescriptive, they aren't going to negotiate on anything. They're not going to try. They're going to say, we're going to cut down everything in the right way. And I don't know if that's what this leads to or not, but we've got to make sure that it doesn't matter so much if you got 20 acres, but if you have a teeny tiny lot and one tree, then, and because they certainly have the rights to do that. And as it is now, they can kind of be a little bit reasonable. I don't know. And I also don't want, by an unintended consequence of actually by making the law, then you end up having the flip side of it be a problem, which I think you already addressed.
If I can, Chairman. You raise really valid concerns. And, you know, in my own neighborhoods, we've had the same issue of the utility coming through and wanting to trim everything down. And the neighbors all come out in force saying, no, don't do that. And the utility says, but we've got to. And so, you know, they come in, they chop the tops off the trees, but they leave the bottom, so they got some shielding. So we've been down that. And in some cases, what they've wanted to take out has been too much in some people's opinion, because they've depended upon the screening, the buffering that's there. But That being said, two things. One is, you know, we do know that some utilities have now already moved into what I think is sometimes called a ground to sky approach. That is, everything in utility from the ground up is going away. And they've, in the case of the lines in my neighborhood, they've come in the last time and said, okay, this is the last time we're going to do a partial trim. Next time we're here, it's all gone. So we're working with the neighbors to let them know about that and saying, now's the time to start planting some new things right outside the right-of-way so that you have some buffer to do that. But, you know, the other piece of this then is that at the end of the day, this is not prescribing how a utility develops their standards and their procedures. They're still going to be run by their co-op and their members to be able to come up with plans that are unique to that utility to come up with what is what they feel is prudent for that one. But I'm definitely with you on this. We had trees in our backyard that the utility wanted to cut all the way down, and we said, gosh, do you really have to? I mean, you know, where's that reasonable area? But this legislation provides the utilities the flexibility to come up with their plan and work with Division of Forestry to do that. It's not requiring anything uniform that would be applied across all utilities in the same way.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. So if a utility incurs a cost that cannot be by law passed on to the ratepayer, how then is that paid for?
Through the chair, I'm not sure if you could you explain what cost you're referring to here. Are you talking about the cost of doing utility maintenance and vegetation, or I lost track of which cost you're referring to.
Well, so the bill says that it keeps the cost down to the ratepayer.
Mm-hmm.
So the legislation is basically saying that any activity related to this and having the plan, writing the plan, getting it approved. Keeping the vegetation away from the homeowner's property and what have you next to the line, any cost that is incurred, we're saying in this bill that it won't be passed on to the ratepayer. And my question is, how can you protect the ratepayer? How does the utility then pay for this?
Thank you. Through the chair, I have to go back and look at that. There certainly is nothing in the bill that is intended to change at all the ability of the utility to do this right-of-way maintenance and to make that a part of their operational expenses. If there's any mention about the costs we're trying to limit in this bill, it is trying to protect the ratepayers and the utilities from the cost of wildfire liability, where they would be asked to pay, as one of our utilities in the valley was, you know, forced to pay a few years ago, to pay the cost of the damages from the wildfire. So it's the wildfire costs that we're trying to protect the utilities from having to bear, particularly in the case like the fire in 2019, where the utility didn't actually, it wasn't the utility's vegetation that even touched the line, but they were the ones because they had a power line and vegetation from adjacent property touched their lines. They were the ones that had to pay the cost of that. So it's those costs we're trying to reduce, not the cost of the actual vegetation management activity.
Well, actually, you asked my question. So in that case that you gave, did the ratepayers end up paying when the utility was found to be liable for the wildfire.
Yeah, thank you. Through the co-chair, I'd have to ask the utilities to respond to that because I don't know in the end how the utility, where the money came from for their settlement at that point. I'd be purely speculating on whether or not they had reserves or some sort of umbrella. I don't know where that came from. We could ask them to come back and share with us a little more about the story of what happened and how they handled that and you know, maybe how this legislation might help them, I hope.
I'll interject a little bit. So I had the pleasure of attending the Alaska Power Association conference in Cordova in September, and concerns about risk for wildfire, I think it's fair to say, was the single largest issue that came up over and over again there. And, you know, some of the examples in the lower 48 of some of the massive wildfires that caused a lot of infrastructure damage, not everybody's got the same business model. And don't have lots and lots of customers to spread. We don't have lots and lots of customers to spread some of those costs along. But yeah, I mean, we're looking at bankrupting utilities because of this. And up here, we've got co-op models and, you know, local governments owning our electrical utilities. So it's a different scenario.
Yeah, thank you. And Chair Mears, you may want to perhaps see if the division director of McDonald, who's, I think, on the line, perhaps he has some thoughts, I don't know, on what we've just been talking about that maybe wants to fill in. But I just wanted to just acknowledge, I think he's online here if we need a resource, and he may know more of the details.
You're gonna pitch him a specific question, or you're going to ask him for everything?
Thank you. I guess I'm just wondering if he has any more specific information about the McKinley fire and what happened there and how those costs were borne. If he doesn't, you know, it'd be appropriate for us to contact the utility and perhaps ask them to come in a subsequent hearing. But I just want to recognize we're talking about a lot of things that he knows a lot about.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Can you chime in here with some support for Representative Holland?
Yeah, absolutely. And good afternoon. For the record, my name is Norm Fowle, Deputy Director of the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection, and I oversee the fire side of the house. I can't speak to how the costs were bared by the utilities. I can tell you for the state of Alaska, we did not go after cost recovery. So that was all done through insurance companies and some sort of class action, but that was not through the state of Alaska.
We'll work on trying to invite them when we get the next hearing scheduled, the utility, to come and answer that question or give us a little more background that they can share.
And thank you. And of course, one of the less direct costs is insurance costs. And if there's mitigation, then you're at better risk. And if these costs go up all over the place, then the cost of insurance goes up. So the better we can keep this in hand, I think it's better globally as well. Any further questions? All right. Thank you for that. We will set this bill aside and take it up next Tuesday with invited testimony. At this time, we'll take a brief at ease. Back on the record. So as I've got the next bill presentation, I will turn the gavel over to Representative Kopp to chair the next portion of the meeting. Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Mears. The next item of business before the committee is an introduction of House Bill 259, Large Energy Use Facilities. Appreciate you and your very able staff coming forward. Please introduce yourselves for the record and begin your overview for the committee.
Thank you, Representative Kopp, Representative Costello, and virtually anyone else that's listening to this elsewhere. I am Representative Donna Mears. I represent the South Muldoon District in East Anchorage. Thank you for the opportunity to present my bill, House Bill 259, Large Energy Use Facilities. If it's the committee's will, I'll get on with the presentation, and my staff, Ariel Svetlik, will conclude with the sectional summary.
Thank you.
House Bill 259 establishes a clear framework to support large new energy users in Alaska. It provides consumer protection and community involvement. We have a small local energy demand along the rail belt and off. In order for new energy projects like renewables to grow our supply, we need to grow demand. Drawing on lessons from other states where inadequate consumer protections is now resulting in project opposition, House Bill 259 balances flexibility for future incentives with safeguards for communities, positioning Alaska to attract new industries, support long-term economic growth, and build a more secure and sustainable energy future, rather than managing a decline status quo. Slide two. Thank you. Last year, when we set out to work on House Bill 259, large energy use facilities, I had specific goals in mind. And before I get to that, I want to also note that we have some folks on the line for support. One of them is Erin McKittrick. She is an Alaska energy analyst and writer, and she also worked for my office during the interim, and she was a big part of working on this bill. We also have, from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, Chair John Espendola, Commissioner John Springsteen, as well as Julie Vogler and Claire Knutson. Thank you all for being online, and I'll do my best to answer questions, but remember we do have some folks on the line that can also help with some technical questions and support. So, specific goals for the bill. I wanted to support new large users coming to Alaska, whether that is on the rail belt or in our islanded systems. I wanted to find a way to do this that would be good for both Alaskans and for business. So, how'd this idea come about? Slide three. Alaska has boundless untapped energy resources. The potential wind, tidal, and geothermal energy alone in Cook Inlet could power the entire rail belt many times over. I do also want to note that this bill is energy source agnostic. I'm just going to put in a plug for the renewables because I think that's where that potential growth could really come from. I have frustrations when the legislator has provided graphs where the energy demand line is flat far into the future. We had this presented to us again last week in resources. Flat energy demand does not encourage economic growth. Our energy infrastructure is aging and needs modernization. We're all familiar with the grid resilience and infrastructure partnerships, which generally we call in this building GRIP. The state has made the investment to match federal funds to upgrade our electrical transmission system, but that's just one example of our aging infrastructure. The introduction of anchor tenants, new large energy users, can help make our electrical grids more resilient, spread the cost for infrastructure upgrades, and therefore reduce unit energy costs for customers through demand growth. Slide four. So, what increases demand? Some of these issues we discussed in committee last year. It includes simple things like beneficial electrification. I had a great chat with AELNP last week about how things like heat pumps and electric vehicles are changing the grid's electrical demand down here in Juneau. The local grid is also balanced out by large demand from Greens Creek Mine. Continued military investment, like the J-Bear Joint Integrated Test and Training Center, which broke ground in Anchorage last September. Energy demand from mining project like Kinross's Fort Knox is Golden Valley Electric's largest customer, and their cooperation stabilizes the grid and lowers costs for Fairbanks area customers. That's the photo that's on here. Their equipment is large and requires quite a lot of electricity to turn those drums there. We've also talked about future fuel opportunities here, like SAF, sustainable aviation fuel. The Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is actively involved in development and implementation initiatives for SAF. And the newest big thing that's on the horizon, data centers. Slide five. Data centers have been exploding in the lower 48, and there is interest in expanding to Alaska. There are several smaller projects already in existence, and more are being explored. Data centers can invigorate local economies, deliver a new slate of business tools and computing power, generate public income, and provide flexibility to utilities. I want to be ready to welcome them onto our grids responsibly. If we learn lessons from others, this could be a really great thing. But right now, if you ask people their opinions on data centers, the replies that you get can be a bit of a mixed bag. But there's real concerns that they're spiking ratepayer bills, and many states are scrambling to institute customer protections. Utilities are facing planning risks from projects that promise to come, but they don't materialize, as utilities have already begun making financial investments to serve their new customers. Communities are concerned about other impacts like noise and water use, as this is a large complaint about some of the mega data centers down south. You'll note in your packet there's an article in there from the Wrangell Sentinel that makes these points. This is just from, I think it was last week or the week before, and the initial community concerns were exactly that, utility rates and community impacts. Slide six. Alaska is uniquely poised to support the development of data centers. Alaska is a resource state, and we have a strong record of developing projects to beneficially utilize our resources. Cooling is a significant portion of the energy needs for data centers, and as this winter keeps proving, cool is an understatement in Alaska. Access to water resources is also an advantage we have over our areas in the lower 48, where data centers are being built in deserts and densely urban areas. We also have the potential for beneficial relationship with other commercial or community projects for utilizing waste heat. And as we have learned in this committee, vast energy resources waiting to be tapped. Cook Inlet alone has projects for tidal and geothermal and development for hundreds of megawatts each. And including offshore wind, the potential energy is well over 30 gigawatts. And as we know, Cook Inlet is just a very small part of our state. Our polar geography places us as a potential hub for global fiber optic interconnection, with projects like Far North Fiber exploring a connection from Ireland to Japan. We already have a history of making strong local industrial economies like in Nikiski, and Alaska has both greenfield and brownfield development sites that already have infrastructure in place. Additionally, prime industrial sites are already zoned out in our state land plans. Slide seven. So, my goals for 259. Create a regulatory framework so that project developers know what to expect when they draw up their business plans for Alaska. Having that certainty is helpful. To protect ratepayers from new infrastructure investments that are made just for these large projects, require fuel certainty, but also allow utilities the flexibility to provide beneficial rates to large users if their usage profiles provide additional benefits to their systems. This bill also requires buy-in through a community benefit agreement process, and I'll talk more about that shortly. Slide eight. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. This bill reduces risks for utilities and creates certainty for investors and projects by laying out take-or-pay stipulations, codifying a clear process based on previous rate cases the RCA has already approved. And provisions from laws and tariff filings in the lower 48 for similar projects. Slide nine. One unique provision in the bill was brought to use to us by labor and community organizations in Alaska. A community benefit agreement is often referred to as a CBA. The CBA empowers local control and allows community buy-in in the project. It creates a place for a municipality to have its direct negotiations with a new large project. So this is where you'd negotiate on perhaps a property tax exemption and for a data center, a mine, or even a new cruise ship dock. And so I guess for ad libbing. For negotiation. So it doesn't require, we don't require anything in the CBA, just that one exists. The content is up to the communities and the developer. So what Fairbanks and Kenai might need out of a business partner will probably be different, and this bill leaves that flexibility. So does a community need help with fire response training and equipment? Do they want to utilize waste heat for your swimming pool? Do you want to create an apprenticeship course with your school district? So there's lots of opportunities to decide to customize what that CBA means for any particular project and community. And this provision creates a certain certainty in process, which helps foster partnerships and helps new projects become something a community can rally around instead of against. So at the end here, by encouraging new energy demand and strengthening our electric grid, HB 259 positions Alaska for the future, investing in sustainable economic growth and long-term energy security rather than managing decline. I'd like to thank the committee for their time and looking forward to questions and work on this legislation. I will now like to pass this over to my staff, Ariel Svetlik, who will read our sectional.
Thank you, House Energy Committee and Representative Mears. Through the through Chair Kopp, I will now read the sectional for House Bill 259, Large Use Energy Facilities, Version N. Section 1 amends Alaska Statute 4205.381 by adding a new subsection R. This states that utilities may not pass along generation, transmission, or distribution costs that exist only because they are serving a large energy use facility to other customers. Those costs must be recovered solely from the large use energy facility and not during rate cases. And during rate cases, the utility must assign those specific costs directly to the facility, not to the general customer base. The definitions used in the subsection are outlined in Alaska Statute 42.05.435. Section 2 adds a new subsection 42.05.435, Contracts for Large Energy Users. This section will take a moment to go through, as it is the bulk of this bill. So paragraph A of this subsection, this paragraph creates parameters for contracts for large energy use facilities that enter into a contract with an electric or gas utility. Paragraph B, these contracts must, and then we break into our subparagraphs, set a minimum contract length of 12 years plus an optional ramp-up period, include purchase quantities, include buyout language requiring meeting 80% of the remaining contract commitments, commonly known as take or pay, and require a minimum exit fee covering costs incurred by the utility or the contract minimum, whichever is greater, if the customer exits the contract prior to concluding the period set in the contract.
Ms. Svetlik, may I interrupt just for a moment? I just want to recognize that Representative Ruffridge has joined us at 2:03 p.m. Thank you, Representative. Please continue.
All right, through the chair, I believe I was at subsection C. The contracts may be modified with approval from the RCA if the modification does not increase the rate cost for other customers. Subsection D, the contracts may not risk fuel supply for any utility in the state. Further plans for any additional fuel supply must be in place if the current systems are not anticipated to provide sufficient supply. Subsection E, the contract must cover the cost of new infrastructure required for the large energy facility. Subsection F, new transmission infrastructure built for the new facility will not initially be considered part of the backbone transmission system. This can be addressed in later rate cases. Subsection G, a contract must include new variable costs and attribute them to the new user. Subsection H details the ways that rates may be set, requiring that costs caused by a large energy use facility must be paid by the large energy use facility. It also allows rate reduction options for verifiable system benefits. Subsection I directs utilities to identify costs for reporting. Subsection J allows the RCA to determine that multi-building units can qualify as a large energy use facility. Subsection K requires a community benefit agreement for a large energy user contract. Subsection L clarifies that this does not apply to utilities furnishing gas or electricity to other utilities. And subsection M adds a couple of paragraphs with definitions. A contract refers to contracts between gas or electric utilities and a large energy use facility. Paragraph 2 defines electric utility as a public utility that provides electric service. Paragraph 3 defines facility to mean all buildings, equipment, structures, and other fixed infrastructure owned and operated by the same entity if the commission decides they should be treated as a single facility. Paragraph 4 defines gas utility as a public utility that transmits or distributes natural gas or manufactured gas. Paragraph 5 defines large energy use facility as a facility that consumes either 20 megawatts or more of peak electrical demand, or at least 20% of an electric utility's annual electric sales, 2 billion standard cubic feet of natural gas per year, or 20% of the utility's annual sales, whichever is the smaller amount. And paragraph 6 defines municipality as within Alaska Statute 2971-800. And then we get to Section 3, which amends the uncodified law with a new section that states that this bill applies when a gas or electric utility enters into a new contract with a large energy use facility once this bill takes effect. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Ruffridge.
Thanks. I promise I was listening online. Apologies for not being here. Thank you for allowing me to come in late. The definition of large energy use facility, I didn't see in the presentation. Are there facilities in Alaska that are currently fall under that definition?
Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, it's not retroactive, but yes. So, for example, Fort Knox Gold Mine is, I think, like 20% of Golden Valley Electric's demand. And it was contracts with GDEA that we looked at to help inform the writing of the bill.
Okay. Thank you. And follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair. So this bill would not affect current users, just new users. It was the applicability section. I didn't see when the effective date was. Maybe that's not in there. But there's no retroactivity to that.
Through the chair, Representative Donemir, Representative Ruffridge, correct. There's no retroactivity. It's a standard bill, so I think it's 90 days after signing into law. So it's whatever the standard process is, nothing special.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Costello.
Well, actually, that was the exact question that I was going to ask, is whether we had any that meet the definition of large energy use facility. Could you provide a committee with the list of all of them if there are more than the one you had mentioned?
Representative Costello, through the chair to Representative Costello, I don't know the level of research that is, but there are multiple examples. Juno here for AELMP, I believe Greens Creek Mine is a significant user and might fall within this, but I don't know the specific size of it. If you don't mind, we can ask Erin McKittrick and see if she has data on that, as she has a wealth of data on energy use in Alaska.
Thank you. And I was curious, is this legislation modeled after any other state, and what did you do when you were preparing this bill? Did you look around the country, and did you find other states that have similar approaches? And along those lines, I've never heard of a community benefit agreement. Is that something new, and where did that idea generate from?
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Costello. I'll throw it to Ms. McKittrick to answer the first bit about not only projects, but like the other, yes, lots of states and other examples, including some in-state contracts that we looked at to generate the legislation. And then I'll answer about CBAs. Ms. McKittrick?
Yes, through the chair. Can't off the top of my head give you a list of every facility currently that exists that would qualify if it were new, but it certainly includes large mines, refineries, that sort of facility, and I could do that offline and get back to you. As far as other, there are many states that have either existing legislation for large energy facilities or proposed legislation, and there are also a lot of settlements and other proceedings at public utility commissions, and we drew from a whole set of those, and I have a very long list on my computer, but I don't know that that would be helpful to read it off at this point.
Yes, Ms. Stafford.
Through the chair, I do have it in my notes, and I can provide that to the committee at a later time.
And I can, do you want me to follow up on CBAs first? So community benefit agreements, they're not new, but they're catching on a bit. They are, the Alaska Municipal League has been advocating for them, I believe, in other areas, and it was brought to us by community groups and labor unions. By having a direct relationship between a project and a local government, you can work out a lot of things that might be issues later, and also provide opportunities for mutual benefit.
Other questions, Mr. Chair?
Follow up, yes.
Thank you. So would the RCA need to be involved in any future project that where there's a large energy use facility coming into the state, or is it, does it skirt the RCA's involvement?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, Representative Donna Mears, it kind of depends. So if it is a large energy user that is on the grid, that is coming in front of the meter to a utility, it will require approval from the RCA. If it's a project that's behind the meter that doesn't that they're providing their own power, they're bringing their own power, then that would not need the contract from the RCA, but they still would require a community benefit agreement.
Thank you, Representative Mayor. So a question I have is, are we hearing from our utility companies that they want this type of prescription for how they will do a contract with a large energy use facility? It seems like we're really getting into what they would negotiate in setting the parameters. What are we hearing from utilities?
Thank you, Representative Kopp. Fortunately, the Alaska Power Association will be here next week, and we can ask a lot of them very specifically. But we have been having conversations with them. And, of course, there's questions whenever there's a new process that comes about. And, yeah, a lot of this they're already doing and have the ability to negotiate contracts for new energy users. On the other hand, having some predictability about knowing what the requirements are is beneficial for anybody out of state looking to do projects here. So when you know what the rules that you're going to play by, that helps encourage stability and predictability for project development.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you. Well, through the chair, more of just an observation first, then I'll get to my real question, which is all your friends left you in a room full of Republicans. I don't know what happened there on an energy bill. So the community benefit agreement combined with the RCA component of this bill, do you anticipate there being a delay at all in a potential for a large energy user? I mean, I appreciate actually very much the highlights of the bill being about the case to bring them to Alaska. Some of those things, though, maybe present a potential barrier where there's steps that someone has to go through that may delay, and any step where government has a delay in the project, I have concerns with. So in other spaces, because you mentioned that community benefit agreements are kind of newer, is there a thought of what time frame that adds to a potential project combined with the RCA need for approval?
Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, Representative Donna Mears. Thank you for the multi-part question and the ability and the rapid fire so that I did not write them all down, so I'll do my best. First off, Representative Ruffridge, I am the only Democrat on the Energy Committee, so it does not matter how many people are in the room at the table. And I'm fine with that. I think I'm holding my own here. As far as the RCA process, first off, I'd like to note that we have zero fiscal note from the RCA. The approval of these contracts for where I imagine most of these facilities would happen already will need to go through this process within the RCA. There is the potential for, you know, projects that come into communities that don't currently have RCA processes that are required that will need to go through that. I'd like Chair Espindola to get into that timeline a little bit. But as far as community benefit agreements go on, are that time process can happen at any point there. It is just the assurance of good process. A community benefit agreement could be like, welcome to the neighborhood, glad to have you. And just an acknowledgement that the project is coming in and the community and they've spoken. But it could get longer. And frankly, some of the municipal processes that would be required, you know, could be quite lengthy to begin with existing land use regulations or ordinances or other requirements that they have. So that process can happen in parallel, and I think is assurance of good faith and good process.
Thanks.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. Is it possible that a community benefit agreement could hold up or stall a project?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, I think we're seeing in the lower 48 that community resistance to project already is holding them up and providing a requirement that community needs be addressed could actually make processes go faster. But it does also assure local control. You know, we're not coming in as a state saying, you know, these are coming to you. It allows the local community to have that autonomy.
Follow it?
Yes, Representative Costello.
So are there signers to a community benefit agreement? And if so, who are they?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, we didn't line that out. I would imagine it would be whoever is the, you know, authority. We do have a definition of municipality that's referred to AS 2971-800. So it would be whoever is in charge of that entity.
One final question.
Yes.
Do you see this bill, if it were to pass into law, impacting or affecting the gas line?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, I think that inviting energy growth with new large users helps whatever energy project we're developing. So the demand for more local natural gas and the utilization of, frankly, existing natural gas electricity generation capacity is beneficial.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, we will now set House Bill 259 as set. I want to thank the bill sponsor and Representative Mears and Ariel Svetlik for that eloquent presentation. We'll be taking this up again at Tuesday's meeting with invited and public testimony. And we'll now take a brief at ease so I can turn the gavel back over to Representative Mears at ease.
Thank you for our discussion today. And with that, seeing no further business before us today, we will conclude the House Energy Committee for today. We will meet this coming Tuesday, February 3rd, where we will hear invited testimony on both House Bill 252 and House Bill 259 and public testimony on HJR 27. With 2 minutes available per testifier. We will also hear public testimony on 259. Reminder, we have set a amendment deadline for HJR 27, which is noon on Monday, February 2nd. If you'll recall, that's how we started off committee last week with the resolution from Representative Holland's office. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 2:23 p.m.